Senator Tammy Duckworth just introduced a resolution that would repeal President Trump's travel ban on five majority Muslim countries. Today, she joins us from Washington to talk about all of that and more. Plus, when you think of performing arts, maybe you think of Chicago. But for 50 years, the Krannert Center in Urbana has been a thriving place for theater, dance, and music. How does the performing arts thrive outside a big city? And we'll talk about some of the biggest shows in television that are wrapping up this year, whether it's Game of Thrones, Big Bang Theory, or Broad City.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
All that and more coming up on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, we know Chicago has a reputation for being a world-class art center, but what about Illinois' other cities? Today, as the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts celebrates its 50th anniversary, we talk to folks working in performance arts and art centers outside of Chicago, in Urbana, Springfield, and Normal. Later, we'll end today's program talking about how many beloved TV series are ending. What's the show you're going to miss the most? Why? Maybe you want to share a favorite episode? Whether it's from Orange is the New Black, Broad City, or Game of Thrones, text us at 217-394-5765. That's 217-394-5765. Save that number in your phone, by the way. That's how you can text us. But first, we've been catching up with a few members of our Washington delegation with a busy week in our nation's capital, whether that's the turmoil in the Department of Homeland Security to continued back and forth over the Mueller report. I spoke about this some more with Senator Tammy Duckworth late yesterday afternoon. Senator Duckworth, welcome back to the 21st.
It's great to be on. Thank you.
So you and Senator Durbin and a few others in Congress just announced legislation that would repeal President Trump's executive order banning travelers from majority Muslim countries. I had a quick look at the co-sponsors and supporters. Are there any Republicans on the list?
I don't think so at this time, no. And it's unfortunate because this is really a very important bill to get passed.
Earlier this week, one of your Republican colleagues, Representative Darren LaHood, was on the 21st, and I asked him about Boeing and the 737 MAX 8 jet. Representative LaHood said while he had confidence in the current leadership of the Chicago-based company, he felt like it was important for the FAA to get to the bottom of what has happened. Do you feel like that's happening?
Well, we have held several hearings on this, and I've had conversations with both the head of NTSB as well as the FAA. And I think this is something that we're going to have to look even deeper into. We have to review not just the development of the aircraft and the self-regulating that occurred with self-certification that where Boeing did their own inspections, but also looking at pilot training and how we recommend pilot training to pilots who fly these aircraft overseas. Because the training requirements are very different for American pilots versus overseas pilots, for example. I think it's going to be an issue, a combination of the technology as well as pilot training.
And when we're talking about the self-regulating, do you feel like the FAA has enough funding to do its job effectively in terms of having enough regulators to be able to be checking inspections and training and all of these things when it comes to these aircraft?
Oh, no. I think the FAA certainly could use more inspectors and more experienced inspectors. And unfortunately, we're in a place now where this administration continues to cut the budget for important programs like inspectors, whether it's the FAA or it's the EPA or any other number of regulatory agencies that really put people's safety at risk.
Senator Duckworth, I wanted to ask you about the report by Special Counsel Robert Mueller. Attorney General Bill Barr has, of course, released a summary he wrote of the Special Counsel's report. That's public. The Attorney General Barr said he'll release a redacted version of the report to Congress. How much of the Mueller report do you think should be presented to the public?
Well, I think first and foremost, 100% of the report should be presented to members of Congress. We all have top secret clearances, so there's nothing in there that we should not be able to see. So that's the first thing that needs to happen. And then once we review them, then we can certainly work with the Department of Justice to see what could be released to the public. But I know the American people want to see the full report, and I don't blame them. I don't know what's in it because I've not been shown it myself.
When we're thinking about Washington, and I know it's been a turbulent week for the Department of Homeland Security, I wanted to just ask you, first of all, about your thoughts on the new appointment for, first of all, U.S. Customs and Border Protection.
Well, I don't know that the new appointee is going to be any better. And it's certainly the departing head of Homeland Security, Secretary Nielsen, was someone that locked up children and put them in cages and separated families. So I'm not sure that the Homeland Security and Customs and Border Protection have a very good track record under the Trump administration.
And when we're thinking about right now and the fact that we have an interim leader, acting secretary is the current Customs and Border Protection, one of the commissioners. Do you feel like how do you feel about our national security and our ability to defend the country in terms of leadership at DHS right now?
Well, I don't think we have sufficient leadership. And in fact, many of the seasoned DHS leadership have now resigned and been forced out or have resigned in order to make way for Trump appointees. And that is very troubling to me. I think that the president has actually jeopardized our national security, not just the DHS, but even with our military. The commandant of the Marine Corps, for example, has said that the deployment of Marines to the border is now jeopardizing Marine Corps readiness in order to fight terrorists overseas. So I think this administration has committed quite a few grave errors when it comes to national security issues, whether it's DHS or whether it's with DOD.
I wondered if I could ask you about when we think about not just military, but first responders. You were tweeting about Chicago police officers. We know there's actually been 7 suicides in the Chicago Police Department since July. And I was just looking at a tweet you said about how some scars and wounds, unlike yours, aren't so visible. And I'm wondering how you think we can reduce the stigma around people who are our first responders getting the mental health help that they need.
Well, this is an issue that I've been dealing with for a very long time, from the time that I dealt with post-traumatic stress for troops. And it began over 15 years ago, where back then troops would lose their secret clearance and they would lose access to their ability to carry weapons or be deployed if they sought mental health counseling. And I know many of our first responders, especially law enforcement officers, are loath to seek counseling because they will lose the ability to do their jobs. I think what we need to do is come up with more funding through Health and Human Services and grant programs that can be deployed to local police forces so that they can then employ their own mental health screening and mental health treatment programs for their own officers. I don't think this is a federal the federal government should come down and say this is how you treat them. But I think the federal government's role should be to provide the funding to help local municipalities implement these programs. I just recently had a meeting with quite a few of our sheriffs and county law enforcement officers just this past week. And that's exactly what they asked for, is help with funding so that they can implement programs to help their own officers.
I wanted to ask you about a bill you've proposed that's actually intended to protect military families from lead poisoning in schools and homes. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so we're finding that many of our military families have been exposed to lead unbeknownst to the servicemen and women, and my bill would require 100% testing of lead in all military housing facilities and also 100% testing of military children for exposure to lead. We know that there are 0% levels of safe lead in the drinking water supply, and it is terrifying to me that the children of our men and women in uniform are being exposed to lead. And I don't think that we should have, troops who are downrange fighting to defend America should be wondering about the safety of their own families in the homes that we are providing them as taxpayers. And so what my bill would do would be to go back and take a look at all of the military housing facilities and make sure that they are lead free, and then to test military children to make sure that we know whether or not they've been exposed.
And so that, to your point, you do think that there has been some studies that show that this is a problem?
Yes, there have been cases and have been exposed that there have been military families in many different bases across the country that have been exposed to lead. Yes.
Senator Tammy Duckworth, thanks for taking the time to speak with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We wanted to follow up on a conversation we had yesterday on the program. Musicians with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra are now on strike, going on their fifth week. Performances until April 23rd have been canceled, including one scheduled in central Illinois at Urbana's Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. On Monday, musicians rejected an offer made by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra Association. That's the organization that manages the CSO. Yesterday, we heard from two musicians who are out on strike and on the negotiating committee. Today, I'm joined by Jeff Alexander, president of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra Association. Jeff, good morning. Welcome to the 21st.
Good morning, Nyla.
Jeff, I wonder if we can first talk about wages. Yesterday, the musicians told us they haven't gotten a cost of living increase in the last 7 years. What are you proposing in the offer you made this past week in terms of wages?
Yes, well, what we've offered to the musicians in our most recent proposal is a 5-year agreement with a 12% wage increase over the 5 years. So we feel that really moves the wages here nicely ahead of where they are now.
And we've heard from the musicians that right now the pension plan is really where negotiations are sticking. We've heard the musicians say specifically they don't want changes to what's called a defined benefit pension plan. What's the thinking behind what you all are proposing now?
Yes, that's correct. So the musicians currently have a defined benefit pension plan. And our proposal is for the current members of the orchestra to stay in that plan either for another 1 to 4 years of their choice. And for the current members, they would have, when they retire, whatever they've earned so far in the defined benefit plan that would not go away. They would still have that at retirement. And then in addition to that, they would have the defined contribution plan benefit that would kick in as soon as they decide to make the transfer either 1 year from now or 4 years from now.
So basically what we kind of know more like as a pension versus a 401k would be how most people would understand how it would work, right?
That's right. That's right.
And is this obviously, I imagine, this conversation is not new across Illinois, whether you're a state worker or apparently a musician at the CSO. I imagine this is a financial reason for why the Orchestra Association cannot afford the traditional pension plan?
That's correct. It is a financial reason. We are, of course, a not-for-profit organization. We rely heavily on, of course, ticket sales for the concerts, but also on contributions. And what's occurred over the past several years, in fact, the conversation about trying to transition from a defined benefit plan to a defined contribution plan has been taking place here for over 20 years. It's just become a more critical point now because of the way calculations have changed and the requirements of how much funding has to be put into the pension plan. For example, about 8 years ago, we were informed that if we, over the 8-year period, put $22 million into the plan, it would be fully funded. Here we are 8 years later. We have put the $22 million in, and the new calculations are that we now have to put an additional $36 million into the plan over the next 8 years. And these numbers are just getting too burdensome. So what we are suggesting is that we would, over time, have to fully fund the pension plan. That's an IRS regulation. We understand that. But making the transition to the defined contribution plan would assist the organization in financial stability going into the future.
Do you worry that shifting to this kind of plan will make the Chicago Symphony Orchestra less competitive compared to other orchestras around the country? Are you worried about recruitment and retention in that sense?
No, and I know that is a concern of the members of the orchestra, but currently there are simply only 4 major orchestras left in the country that have the defined benefit plan. That's Chicago, New York, San Francisco, and Boston. There are other great orchestras in this country that have a defined contribution plan, and they continue to be great orchestras, and I'm sure the Chicago Symphony Orchestra would continue to be a really great orchestra as it is now. And has always been, going into the future. And I think recruitment would be fine. If you think of a young musician eager to work in a wonderful artistic environment, their interest is in that. Where can they go to work where the artistic level is extremely high? Of course, they want to have a good retirement, but the defined contribution plan would give them that.
you know, Jeff, strikes can be pretty messy and ugly, and I think it's fair to say that's usually always a last resort that no one on either side really wants. I wonder if you worry about how the orchestra management will be perceived in all of this, the orchestra itself, especially among patrons, as we think about how much you're already competing for patrons' time and money.
Of course, none of us wanted a strike, and we were sorry that the musicians decided to go on strike. We were having conversations. We would have been willing to continue the conversations, and we're eager for it to end as soon as possible. I know the musicians are as well. We have a very, very strong and loyal fan base here in Chicago and actually across the country and around the world, and I'm sure once the strike is over, those fans will be very, very delighted to come back and hear the orchestra.
That said, where do you go from here?
Well, we look forward to further discussions with the musicians' negotiating committee to see if we can come to a resolution. We have made really good progress on virtually every other topic that we were discussing through the negotiations. We've come to many agreements, actually, on many areas of the contract. It's these two items, which are typically the two last items that are resolved, wages and pension, that we have to we finish up talking about.
Jeff Alexander is president of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra Association, speaking to us about the ongoing strike that is happening in Chicago with orchestra members. Jeff, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We're going to continue our arts conversation just after the break by looking at some other Illinois cultural institutions. The Krannert Center for the Performing Arts in Urbana celebrates its 50th anniversary this weekend. That got us wondering about running and sustaining arts organizations outside of Chicago, so we're going to talk about that. But before we take that break, yesterday morning, the world saw its first ever picture of a black hole. I don't know if you've seen it yet. It's in a galaxy called M87. It's 55 million light years away. If you've ever seen artist renderings of a black hole, this is a little blurrier, but it is the real thing. There's an Illinois connection we wanted to share with you about this story. Scientists and grad students at the University of Illinois, led by Professor Charles Gammy, played an important role in the findings that were released yesterday. Specifically, they helped figure out the mass of this enormous black hole. How big? Well, it contains the same mass as 6.5 billion suns. That is big. If you haven't seen the picture yet, we'll tweet it out at 21STShow. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. For 50 years, people in Central Illinois have been coming to the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts to see performers like Yo-Yo Ma and Joshua Bell, as well as ballet companies, acrobats, musicians from all over the world. This weekend, they're celebrating those five decades with a Come Home to Krannert Center weekend. And it's an achievement not just for the University of Illinois, but for art across the state. And it got us here at the 21st thinking about other great arts organizations and institutions in the state that exist outside of Chicago. We've gathered a few of them to join us for a conversation. As always, we'd love to hear from you, especially for our listeners in Central Illinois. We want to hear about your favorite or most memorable performance you ever attended at Krannert. You can text us at 217-394-5765. That's 217-394-5765. You can save that number in your phone to text us. Please share your first name. Here in studio with me in Urbana is Mike Ross, the director of the Krannert Center for Performing Arts. Hi, Mike. Thanks for being here and congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your interest in the arts and for this invitation.
In Springfield at our partner station WUIS, Betsy Dollar is the executive director of the Springfield Arts Association. And from our partner station WGLT in Normal and the town of Normal, Adam Fox is a civic arts manager who oversees programming at the Normal Theater. Betsy, Adam, thanks for being here as well. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Mike, I wanted to start with Krannert. Thinking about 50 years, we've got people who are listening throughout the state of Illinois who maybe aren't as familiar with Krannert's mission. What's the easiest way to understand what you all are trying to do at the Krannert Center?
Be glad to respond to that. And I'd also like to start by saying there are two Krannerts at the University of Illinois. the Krannert Art Museum and Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, both made possible through the generosity of Herman and Elnora Krannert. Herman was an alum of the College of Engineering here at Illinois. In reflection of the land-grant public university mission of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, we think of Krannert Center as a potent blending of classroom, laboratory, and public square. And as such, Krannert Center has a deep commitment and responsibility to support the academic performing arts programs, that is to say the School of Music and the departments of dance and theater. And it also has a deep responsibility and commitment to, as a public square, to present a very diverse and robust spectrum of performances across those art forms.
And when we think about how far do people travel to come to the Krannert Center here to attend your performances?
We've had people travel literally from all over the world, actually, to
in the audience. Yes. To attend performances as well.
Yes, I meant to say audience members. For example, when we have our biennial Elnora Guitar Festival, we have guitar enthusiasts that literally come from all over the country. But on an ongoing basis for our programming, people will come from Chicago, St. Louis, Indianapolis. But the vast majority of our audiences on an ongoing basis are from within a 75-mile radius or so in central Illinois.
Yeah, that's still a pretty big radius. And I wonder, Betsy Dollar is also with us with the Springfield Arts Association. So, Betsy, we've been talking about Krannert celebrating 50 years. The Springfield Arts Association is actually twice as old. How did this get started?
The primary difference here is that we are a visual arts organization primarily and not performing arts. But it was actually started by three women who believed that all of society could be improved through beauty and the education of the arts, so that the more people understood the visual arts and beauty, the better overall society would be. So they created the Springfield Art Association to basically educate the people of the Springfield area in the visual arts, anywhere from teaching classes, bringing in lots of visiting artists and lectures and opportunities to experience the arts for everyone.
And that's still true today, Betsy?
Yes, yes.
And Adam, when we're thinking, we've got three very different arts organizations, when we're talking about the Normal Theater, also quite a historic institution opening in 1936. I wonder, can you tell us a little bit about the theater and if what you all know has changed since then?
Well, sure. Back in 1937, when the theater opened, it was independently operated, single-screen cinema in the heart of Normal to bring film to the community. And it went through a lot of different iterations over the years, eventually falling into relative disrepair until the town of Normal said, we've got this real gem here, and we're watching it sort of wither away. And in 1994, the town reopened the theater under its ownership and operation. So we are a unique entity. There's very, very few art house cinemas that are part of a municipality and are considered in much the same way as programming like the pools and things like that about quality of life and something that really matters. So we're in our 25th anniversary now under town leadership, and it's a really remarkable organization to be able to look at community from within the community. It's a wonderful relationship.
So it's nice to have the three of you here and think about the more than a century of work doing arts across Illinois. And I don't know if you can have that conversation without talking about funding. And Adam, I just wanted to ask you, when we think about the Normal Theater being part of a municipal city budget, I wonder how that changes what you want to do and what you're able to do?
Well, we're certainly aware of it. I guess I'll say that. The wonderful thing that happened when the theater first opened is that the commitment was made by the town to not try to directly influence the programming. of the theater, the realization that the stories being told on screen had value. And the hope, of course, is that people would come out, that financially it would be well supported by that, but that there was a value in those stories being told irrespective of that. It was never meant to be a profit generator. It was meant to try and share those stories that would resonate with all members of the community. So likewise, and this is perhaps tangential, but there's no real censorship considerations as far as, well, is this the right film to show at a community venue? The town has been very supportive always of saying there is a value in all art as long as it's framed and contextualized correctly. So we certainly consider it, and of course we're hoping that every seat is full in the theater every single night, but we also know that there's some programming that's a little bit more niche or specific, and that there's a real value in that too. So it's a balancing act, to be sure.
Right. That's Adam Fox, the civic arts manager for the town of Normal, talking to us about the Normal Theater. Mike Ross is also in studio with me here in Urbana, where he's director for the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. And Mike, when we think about the funding model for Krannert, obviously, I imagine being attached to the University of Illinois, I wonder if that's given you maybe more stability than if we're thinking about other standalone arts organizations. How the funding structure has changed of Krannert over the years, though, correct?
Yes, it has. In sync with the funding that has changed, the state funding that has changed for the university at large. I am very fond of stating that, in my view, the business model or the financial model of Krannert Center is utterly dependent upon the unflinching commitment of university leadership and the passionate generosity of our donors. Every year, roughly a third of our budget is provided by the University of Illinois, and that's primarily to cover the bulk of our staff salaries. But we rely very heavily on contributed support and also our earned revenues, which are a mix of ticket sales. We have some rental income, and then there's income that comes in from our food services and our Promenade gift shop and showcase.
When we're thinking about arts organizations and funding, for you, how much of the continuing funding is one of your biggest challenges or something you spend a lot of time thinking about?
We spend an enormous amount of time thinking about this. And Krannert Center has been fortunate for a long time to have a very talented and dedicated staff, part of whom are dedicated to the development and fundraising efforts. As part of our 50th anniversary celebration, in fact, we are in the midst of a very ambitious $30 million Endow the Dream campaign to enhance our existing endowment and to ensure that we are able to pursue our mission vigorously and have the kind of impact on this region that we want to have. And so, yes, it's very much on our minds all the time.
Betsy, what about for you? I mean, when we're thinking about you being in our state capital and thinking about all of the conversations for state funding and for thinking about people arguing for funding for things like housing or food, how is it ever hard to convince people of the necessity for arts and arts education in a community like Springfield?
Oh, absolutely. I would say that a huge chunk of the population perceives the arts in general and, you know, the visual arts perhaps in particular, as a luxury and something for the wealthy or the higher end. And so it's an ongoing challenge to convince everyone that art has value for everyone at every age and every income level, and that the world is a much better place when your creativity and imagination are utilized. And I am constantly making the case for really improved education around the arts and far more integration of the arts into every learning situation, so that there isn't this huge chasm between oh, the arts are for the people over there, and you know, everybody else who's trying to survive is over here. I firmly believe that the arts enhance daily survival, and it really helps to have a good imagination and some creative approach, and that you know, we all of you know, whether it's film or music or painting or whatever, that we really serve people to, you know, unleash that inner creativity. We all have it, but so much of our daily environment is very busy beating that out of us. And I think that we need to turn back to that as a resource for, you know, everyone, and to enhance our communities through the arts. Mm. But it is always an uphill battle. And I totally agree that we all rely very heavily on the passionate generosity of the few.
Mm-hmm. We'd love to hear from our listeners, by the way. If you want to share your favorite or most memorable performance you've ever attended at CranArt, you can text us at 217-394-5765. That's 217-394-5765. I will share. I really enjoyed seeing the UI Black Chorus. This was actually just a very recent performance. This was 2 months ago. I've been to many performances at CranArt, but just listening to the acoustics and listening to that music and that sound of that chorus. Mike, I wonder if we could, just to Betsy's point about the arts, just ask a little bit about the building and the acoustics itself, and when this was constructed, when we're thinking about CranArt Center. I understand even the Chicago Symphony Orchestra comes to record here in Urbana because of the acoustics of the Great Hall, correct?
The orchestra has recorded some of its most significant and landmark recordings at CranArt Center in the Folinger Great Hall because of those acoustics. The Great Hall is a great place to start when you think about CranArt Center. And for those folks out in your listenership who are not familiar with CranArt Center, in addition to the Great Hall, which is a beautifully designed concert hall, we have two proscenium theaters, the Tryon Festival Theater and the Caldwell Playhouse Theater. And we also have a black box theater, which we call the Studio Theater. In addition to all those performance spaces, we have a full array of production shops, as in scene shop, costumes, props, audio and lighting. And we have a full array of rehearsal spaces, the footprints of which mimic the stage dimensions of each of the theaters, so that when students and faculty are rehearsing in those spaces, they can easily move from those spaces right onto the stage of the theater in which they are doing their public performing without having to adjust their spacing, et cetera. And there are the lobby itself is an important element of the design of CranArt Center. Herman and Elnora CranArt wanted for there to be a vast lobby space where before and after performances in the theaters, people could come together in spite of their preference for that moment for seeing either dance or theater or music. In
they're
one of the
all
spaces.
Together they're, in the lobby, and no matter what arts they've, whatever performance they've seen earlier.
Yes, and if I could just add one more comment, one of the things that we've done over the years is add to our lobby a stage. We call it Stage 5, and a bar, and we create an ongoing club-style setting. We feature local artists all the time, as well as faculty and students, and it's a joyous enterprise. And when CranArt Center was built and opened in 1969, it captured the attention of all of the cultural elites in the performing arts on the East Coast and the West Coast, because nobody imagined ever that a facility of this complexity and comprehensiveness, vastness, and beauty would appear in the heartland the way CranArt Center did.
And so I wonder if we can end just by asking, and Adam, let me start with you. I wonder if you could just if you can just answer the question about why it's so important to have things like the Normal Theater or CranArt, or as we've been talking to the Springfield Arts Association, and have this exist outside of the coasts or even outside of Chicago.
Well, I think what Betsy said was really fantastic, the notion that the arts is for everybody, and that's from both performance but also participation. We have this assumption that the arts are for something, you know, are something that people over there can do, right? They're up on stage, they can do it, and maybe that's not for me because I haven't made it. I haven't achieved that as my profession. That's not my vocation, but the arts are for every day, for every person, for their entire life. And participation in the arts is a really critical element of having a thriving community, having a better perspective and growing as a person. And I think when you have these vibrant art centers and these commitments within communities to say the arts matter, you just see that have an impact on everybody on every level.
Thanks for sharing that. That's Adam Fox with the Town of Normal. I want to thank Betsy Dollar with the Springfield Arts Association, Mike Ross, the director of the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. We haven't had a chance to talk about all the events that are happening this weekend. We will tweet all of that out and have it at our website. Guys, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
4 and 3 and 2 and 1, 1.
Oh, what up, my babies?
Madonna, Rihanna, Elena.
I'm the king of America.
Will you look at that gorgeous tush?
Same on my butt?
Yes. Yes, queen. Yes, queen.
Sheldon loves Amy, and he would never hurt her on her wedding day or any other day, so park it. Oh, you sit down, too.
Are you going to let her talk to me like that? Say something.
Thank you.
Leon,
yeah.
I'm not sure about this part where I say I want to be president for all Americans. I mean, do I? You know, all of them?
How about real Americans?
Oh, yeah, that's good. And okay. Then we can figure out what I mean later.
They're coming. Our enemy doesn't tire, doesn't stop, doesn't feel.
Can you name all four of those shows? That was Broad City, Big Bang Theory, Veep, and Game of Thrones. Very different programs, of course, but they all have one thing in common. They're ending this year. There are lots more big name shows we're saying goodbye to in 2019, whether we're talking about Orange is the New Black, Jane the Virgin, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. If you have a favorite all-time show that's wrapping up soon, tell us about it. You can text us at 217-394-5765. Make sure you include your first name and hometown. Maybe you have a favorite episode you want to share with us or what you're looking forward to, how you think Game of Thrones is going to end. Again, you can text us at 217-394-5765. In the meantime, I'm joined by two TV enthusiasts to reminisce about all of these programs. Eric Adams is the AV Club's TV editor. He's on the line with us now from Chicago. Hey, Eric, welcome back to the 21st.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And joining us from NPR in Washington is Linda Holmes. She's a writer and editor. You probably know her best as the host of Pop Culture Happy Hour. Hey, Linda, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
So before we even get into these shows, Linda, I think it's so hard to get a show on the air in the first place. And I think it's really hard then to have multiple successful seasons, as we're talking about with these shows, a lot of which of these shows have had a great run. How hard is it when you've had that history to land a final season well?
Well, I think one thing that makes it a little bit easier is that some of these shows, most of these shows, I would say, are ones that have had a little bit of an endpoint in mind, in terms of they're not designed to try to run for 15 years, with the exception of The Big Bang Theory, which of course is. But if you're talking about something like Crazy Ex-Girlfriend or Veep, these were designed to end, if that makes sense. And I think even with Game of Thrones, now that they're ahead of the books, I mean, there was an endpoint in mind. The idea wasn't that these things could be infinite. And I think that has made sticking the landing a little bit easier for some of these shows.
And is there, Linda, I guess, a right time then to end a show if they haven't had that kind of baked into it in the way some of these have? Because obviously you don't want to overstay your welcome. And that's maybe sometimes a hard thing to do when you have a successful franchise going.
Well, I think And I think maybe Eric would agree with me that the best time to end most shows is two seasons before they actually end. And that's often a good rule of thumb. So if you can get in your time machine and go back two seasons from when you actually ended your show and end it then, that's usually about right.
Oh, I would say that makes sense for Veep. Eric, what about Game of Thrones?
Well, I mean, Game of Thrones is such a strange and completely unusual phenomenon for television in that, like, it has made such a hugely popular thing out of something that was for so long kind of dismissed as incredibly nerdy, you know, these epic fantasy sagas. But, you know, like Linda was saying, like, this is the sort of thing that when George R. R. Martin sits down to start writing these novels in the 90s, like, certainly he has some sort of endpoint in mind. And then when it comes to television and just the way that it sort of shook out, you wind up in this interesting scenario where the show winds up getting ahead of the books. And HBO, you know, recognizes when that show needs to end, but they're also doing a whole lot to keep that world alive. They've, you know, ordered so many potential spin-offs, and even if the end of Game of Thrones is coming, the end of Game of Thrones is still a while off.
I should add for our Illinois audience that George R. R. Martin is a graduate of Northwestern University of the Medill School of Journalism. He is a fellow alum like I am and turned to writing after journalism. He decided it didn't really work out for him, and obviously it did. Eric, I'm not a regular Game of Thrones watcher. I will say I stopped watching very early. I stopped at the Red Wedding, basically. But when we think about this show and how it has these kind of crazy, unexpected, shocking twists and turns, especially when characters die off or in some cases come back to life, do you think it's possible to still have an element of surprise when we're talking about Game of Thrones now on its eighth and final season?
I think it's become even harder for it to surprise us, not only that we get kind of desensitized to those big shocking moments, but also like the number of characters on the show has whittled down so much now where you can't really like knock off a Jon Snow in the premiere coming up this weekend, because like we've now placed this huge expectation that like on a character like that, or like Daenerys Targaryen, that like they're going to make it to the end. And it kind of winds up having this effect on the show, in that not only did the show used to be sort of unpredictable, but also the concept that I think drew a lot of people to A Song of Ice and Fire, which is the series, the books that the TV show is based on, is that it did so much to kind of subvert expectations and conventions for fantasy narratives, and as
yeah,
it goes
Eric,
on
do
longer
you think,
and longer, I think it gets more conventional.
Well, that's what I wonder. Do you think they will make it to the end, or do you think they'll do something kind of like a Walking Dead was very smart about? Sorry, I'm spoiling Walking Dead if you haven't watched it in the past year, but you know, Rick, everyone thinks Rick is dead, but in reality, he's been spirited away, and he's going to have a whole other spin-off TV world. Is that kind of a new avenue that's maybe opened up for Game of Thrones as well, where maybe people think they're dead, but they're not?
I mean, that could be possible. It could also be possible that, you know, like, that the ranks of characters that are still around, there could be, like, there's a character like Gendry, who is the illegitimate son of the former king, who's sort of been like hanging around in the background for the last few seasons. And there's a lot of speculation that like maybe he's going to come to the forefront now. So, you know, I guess Game of Thrones did itself a favor early on by introducing so many characters. That
there were plenty to kill off, right?
Yeah, it can still kind of surprise us, even though the ranks have been whittled down.
So let's switch gears to another HBO show, one of my personal favorites, Veep. It's also a show about power, although I guess you could say the dragon is really just Julia Louis-Dreyfus and the main character. Linda, when you look back on Veep, what moments stand out to you the most?
Well, the funny thing about Veep for me is that I often don't really remember what has happened. When they take a break between seasons, especially this last break has been even longer than usual, I rarely remember what was happening plot-wise. Mm-hmm. So what tends to stand out to me are either dynamics between characters, like the The dynamic between Selena, the character played by Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and her body
Gary,
man, Gary,
her bag man,
who's played by Tony Hale, that dynamic and the conversations that they have will stick out to me. But I rarely can remember who is in what job when you come back to Veep. And fortunately, it doesn't matter that much. But what the exact machinations are always slips away from me in between seasons. So I'll usually hit up the Wikipedia entries a little bit to remind myself what in the heck was going on.
Well, when also the fact that it's a show about politics is pretty challenging. A comedy about politics in 2019. I wonder how you think Veep has handled being in a show about the White House in Washington and not thinking about or interacting with the current White House in Washington.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, I had a conversation with another critic who's a friend of mine, in which we had both watched the first couple of new episodes of Veep, and we said, have these people gotten more racist and more awful than they used to be, even though we knew they were awful, or are we just noticing it more because we haven't seen it in a while? And I don't think we reached a final conclusion, but I think for me, it plays a little bit differently when it feels less like it feels less unlikely that these are things that politicians might actually say in private. And so I think the show has not really changed, but the context in which the show exists has changed enormously. And so it's almost like by not responding, they have accidentally moved relative to the real world because the real world has moved so much.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I'm speaking with Linda Holmes, host of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour, and Eric Adams, TV editor for the AV Club, talking about some of the TV shows that are wrapping up in 2019. Eric, Broad City from Comedy Central aired its final episode on March 28th after five seasons. I actually haven't seen that yet, but what do you think about them, Abby Jacobson, Alana Glazer, kind of going out on a high note? Maybe not spoiler for people who haven't seen it yet, but when we're talking about ending on the right note, having a final season, do you think they've done that?
I absolutely think that they did, and I also am averse to giving out any spoilers on the radio, but I will say that a really nice thing that the finale does is it makes explicit this kind of subtext of these relationships that we form with TV shows as we watch them. Broad City was a show that was like 100% through and through about friendship and depended on this relationship that exists both on screen and off screen between Alana Glazer and Abby Jacobson, and the show drew so much power and humor and emotion from that connection. And this final season was really about like both showing how those people and those characters could potentially exist apart but still be connected, while also kind of paying tribute to the stories they had told and the lives that they had lived within this fictionalized New York. And at the very end of the finale, it kind of turns it into this really wonderful visual metaphor that kind of suggests that the real Broad City was the friends that we made along the way.
Oh, nice. Okay, now you have me looking forward to seeing this. We should talk about Big Bang Theory on CBS. Has been running since 2007. By the time it ends, it will have broken the record for most episodes ever by a multi-camera comedy that's even more episodes than Cheers. Eric, I know you were talking to our producers ahead of time about how this isn't necessarily your favorite, but this is a pretty popular show.
Oh, yeah, this show is hugely popular, and it's funny to be talking about Big Bang Theory and Game of Thrones in the same breath because, you know, like, they're both hugely popular shows, but one, Game of Thrones, seems to have a greater impact on the culture at large. You know, we don't talk about Big Bang Theory to the level of analysis or dissection that we do Game of Thrones, but there are certainly more people who are more familiar and more connected to the characters of Big Bang Theory than would be watching a premium cable show like Game of Thrones. So I was looking at the ratings for the shows before I got on the phone, and the last Game of Thrones season finale had 12 million viewers, which is right around where the Big Bang Theory audience is right now. So it's, you know, they're
that is interesting.
Kind of lack monocultural shows that we have.
So we're almost out of time.
Everybody is watching.
Yeah, we just have about a minute left. Linda, I know you like Big Bang Theory, but I just want to ask you, do you have a personal favorite of any other show we haven't talked about of all of the shows that are ending this year that you want to mention, Linda?
Yeah, I want to mention Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, which wrapped up last week. And I think they had a wonderful finale, really true to the show, and stuck the landing in a situation where it looked like it was going to be very hard to do.
Eric?
Oh, sorry, I missed the question.
Oh, just what another show ending this year that's a favorite?
Oh, You're the Worst, which did a similar thing to Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, where it made this point about romantic love that doesn't necessarily have to end with marriage, that I felt was uncommon to television shows, and made it feel like the characters could live on beyond the bounds of the series.
Oh, nice. You're the Worst. Okay, we've got lots of other ones, and you can find out more, of course, about all of these TV shows by reading Eric Adams, listening to Linda Holmes. We will tweet out links to all of the stuff they've been working on. Linda, Eric, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
That does it for us today. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. You can always head to 21stshow.org for more information about the show. If you want to leave us feedback, find past episodes, find out information about today's show, just go to 21stshow.org. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here Monday.